Good morning. So, as we discussed before I started recording, I have that update to SimTime. The original version, basically, it didn't figure out, look for, is someone actually waiting to do something? In all the cases, it showed out before advancing the clock. Hopefully the new version fixes it. If it doesn't, you can use the real-time mode. The history of that assignment is that the original version that Campbell used did not have the SimTime feature at all. So that's the one that definitely works, but I figured it was really annoying to, wait a minute to run each simulation. Now let's talk about things we covered last time. So last time we finished up talking about wireless, talking about this sort of centrally scheduled version of wireless, where we have some central transmitter plan the transmissions for each time stat that everyone would make. And in this design, all the transmissions would be to the base station within an area. If we had overlapping base stations, since we are using sort of allocated spectrum, it's not like Wi-Fi where anyone can set up a Wi-Fi access point, we would coordinate which frequencies were used by which base stations so they wouldn't interfere. And we have these sort of two dimensions. We can set the frequency of the transmissions on the time, and everything goes to the base station. And we mentioned that, since everything goes to the base station and these devices might be far away, we can account for propagation delay here, at least approximately, so we can have things coordinated in these relatively small time steps, even though they're, transmitting from far away locations, and we know radio signals aren't actually instant. Then we moved on to the topic we'll continue today, which is about packet filtering. So a common thing that people want to do in a environment where you have some privately run networks is they want to control what traffic goes into those networks or sometimes out of those networks. And kind of a common philosophy for this is that we'll divide our network into these zones. Like we'll say, we'll have the external stuff, we have the internal stuff, and we have maybe some zone for services. We want to access internal stuff, but we want accessible to the outside. And we'll enforce rules on what packets go between these zones. And kind of the simplest way of doing it is we're going to have basically some program that looks at every packet and decides, do I let this in or not? And we often call this a firewall, and we saw a way in sort of with Linux's NetFilter tools of writing these sort of little programs that would be evaluated by typically a router or maybe some specialized box that would be in a similar place to a router in our network configuration. And we mentioned that, since we're violating one of the things we talked about earlier in the class, this end-to-end principle, that, we aren't having most of the work be done at the ends here, we run into some new issues. So one of these new issues was with IP fragmentation, that if we want to filter on things that are not at the very, very beginning of an IP packet, well, IP had this clever idea that routers don't need to know about whether a packet's split into multiple pieces, but that doesn't work if we're not just looking at the stuff routers need. And more generally, we have this issue that we're going to be interpreting these packets in our firewall when we have firewall rules, especially as we get more complicated firewall rules. And our interpretation might differ from the end host's interpretation. And that's a really hard thing to avoid and is likely to make it so that our security properties we were trying to enforce with those rules don't work the way we expect, or we break other functionality. So we have the example with TCP. If we did the naive thing and said, if the TCP flags are SYN, let it through, otherwise don't let it through, then we have an issue that, there's other things that might be interpreted the same as the flags being SYN, depending on how our end host works. And we don't actually know that at the firewall because we don't run the end host code there. We can't check what it actually does. Then we talked briefly about the idea that we can apply these same firewall ideas, and often do, to kind of higher level protocols. And the cleanest way of doing that is to have something that sort of actually communicates in that higher level protocol. And for HTTP, we can do that. HTTP has this notion of proxies, and including reverse proxies that are kind of invisible to clients. And we can just deliberately set one up and have it do not packet filtering, but request and response filtering. You could also attempt to do this, as we'll mention briefly later, you know, without setting up a proxy, and just by doing packet filtering and doing lots of state tracking, basically re-implementing the web server. And you might think no one would ever do that, but that's not true. People actually do this and deploy this in real companies and sell it commercially. But speaking of sort of like making the firewalls more complicated, we're not going to talk about the details of making a firewall like that, like is that complicated, that like somehow does everything a proxy does even though we're doing packet filtering allegedly. But there is some amount of state that we want for, you know, our sort of simpler, very common firewall rules. And this came up with connections. And we'll talk more about how that works and some things that can go wrong when we're doing that kind of filtering. So questions about these things we covered last time before talk a little more about firewalls. Okay, so there's one thing I probably should have covered last time that I want to talk about with web application firewalls in particular, or just proxies in general, but especially web application firewalls where we're trying to filter requests and responses. And this has to do with that issue that, you know, there's different interpretations. And we saw like there was a concern of that with like TCP or IP fragmentation. HTTP kind of has its own flavors of this, and this is kind of true of most higher level protocols. You need to think really carefully about all the ways your protocols can work. And the classic example in HTTP is something that's commonly called request smuggling. This is a way that sort of proxies, including our web application firewalls, can get confused. And you can see what I've done here is I have two content length headers. And there's an interesting question of which one are we going to use? And what people have noticed in practice is that historically, it was often the case that the proxy would use a different one than the web server at the end. And that's not good, because this means that, let's say the proxy uses the first one and the web server at the end uses the second. The proxy sees, oh, I'm going to send this, and then I have a next request starts here. But if it sends those two requests right after each other, the web server at the other end is going to say, oh, the first request is this thing. And the second request is that /malicious. So by desyncing our proxy and our end web server, we've managed to, you know, sort of smuggle something where our filter will say, oh, that wasn't a /malicious request. That was something else. And, you know, I chose bad method here, which maybe we'd filter out, but obviously I could have chosen something more innocent. And we could have these sort of multiple interpretations. And this problem sort of comes up again and again. The HTTP solution to this is that in the latest revision of HTTP 1.1, they say that if you get two content length headers, you are supposed to drop the connection and to return an input. Like that's their solution to this problem. But of course, there's a question of, do people implement that? Because if you think of implementing your web server, would you have ever tested this? And there's other ways that this problem can come up depending on what the protocol looks like. But basically, we have to worry when we're doing this type of proxying or firewall rules about how can this be interpreted differently. And the sort of main principal defense against this, which is maybe not so great, is normalization. That you take the stuff, take your, say, HTTP request, and you remove stuff you don't understand and put it in a standard format. That's disappointing if we're thinking of, what if I implemented a cool new feature in my web server? If my proxy doesn't understand it and we're doing this normalization, it probably doesn't work. But that's kind of the cost we're going to pay for, you know, making sure that we understand everything we're forwarding and what it, how it's going to be interpreted. This also means that, you know, our firewall or, you know, is going to be, or web application, web proxy or whatever is going to be less efficient, right? Because what we'd really like to do is just like copy bytes, not like process them. But this kind of tells us maybe we can't really do that. We have to actually do extra computation, which is going to make it slower. And that's happens. So questions about our request smuggling example. And as I mentioned, this is only one form this problem can take, right? So we can imagine other things. So in HTTP 1.1, right, you could imagine if there's multiple ways of interpreting chunk transfer coding, which has these chunk sizes, that could also be a problem. Okay, so let's get back to talking about stateful firewalls, where we finished up last time. That this is for the common policy that we want to allow, say, outgoing connections only. This is not the only way we would use this, but, you know, we want to filter out things that aren't part of active connections, and usually that's how we think of what my firewall is supposed to do, that I want to prevent you from contacting me, but not the other way around. You know, those are the sorts of firewall rules that people who are, you know, in charge are going to tell the system administrator to set up. But to actually implement that, we need to track some state. And we're going to basically, most of the time, track connections. And connections is going to be broadly construed. So for example, we can make DNS queries over UDP. And that's typically how DNS queries are made. That means we need to track that as a connection, even though there's not like a connect operation. So we'll have stateful firewalls, and the big thing that they'll usually track is basically a list of active connections. And how do we maintain that list? Well, it's going to depend on the protocol. But for TCP, like the simple idea is that, well, we know a packet with a SYN indicates the start of a connection, and a packet with a FIN followed by some FINAC and ACK indicates the end. And basically what we're actually going to do is we're going to look at the TCP state machine and implement it and run it again in this middle host. We're going to track where the TCP state machine should be and use that to determine whether the connection is active or not. And when the state machine goes to one of those closed, you know, states, we're going to say the connection is no longer active and forget about it. So we're kind of reproducing the work that would be done on the end host in order to track this connection. Now, for TCP, this was nice and straightforward. For UDP, it's a little less straightforward. And what happens in practice there is that, you know, we're going to still have a table of connections, and we're just going to make a guess for UDP that, oh, they sent something, probably something is going to be sent back. And our heuristic guesses we're going to have for all cases, we're going to have a timeout for the connections we're tracking. But timeout's going to depend on the details. So with TCP, where you can kind of guess what the timeout should be based on how TCP works. For UDP, we kind of have to make a wild guess about what that timeout should be. And here we're already running into problems. I'll mention later that, we could disagree about what connections exist versus the end host, because we're tracking it with different code, with different numbers. It's not going to be the same. But Linux does this tracking, and it basically maintains a table of all the active connections along with some extra metadata. And it uses this to mark the packets, not externally, but internally when they're handled by the firewall, with the connection state. And these marks, and we can use the marks in firewall rules. So we'll be able to do something where we do something different with packets that are marked as part of an established connection versus packets that are marked as not part of any valid connection. That's what I messed up. I forgot to put a slot in. Well, so we also have this state called related, which is, this is the slide I forgot to put in. Talk about in a bit. So, but one issue here is we have this problem with stateful firewalls, right? We're tracking this table. There's a question of how big can that table get? And this is not going to have good answers. And this is a particularly a problem, from a security point of view, because what are we going to do if the table gets too big? And we basically have two answers, both of which are very dissatisfying. So one answer is that we stop tracking certain connections and probably therefore make the packets and make those packets be filtered out. Another option is we stop tracking connections and let packets in that we normally should be filtering out. Both of those pretty unsatisfying. And particularly it's unsatisfying because if you're attacking a firewall, it's very easy to create a lot of connections. It's cheap for you to do that. And each time you do that, we're going to have to store some state until timeout expires. And when you're creating connections, you don't need to create successful connections, right? You can just send things because our rule is basically we see a SYN packet and we add to a table. And we remove from that table after a timeout. Typically, that timeout's going to be at least on the order of seconds. So even though normally we'd expect a connection to be completed in like milliseconds. And so we can do what's known as a SYN flood. So we just send tons of SYN packets, tons of connection creation packets. And we can make this more effective by forging IP addresses or compromising machines. So like you can't easily filter it out often by just like looking at the IP. And well, to do that, you probably need to have someone like figure out that this is happening and add a new firewall rule. And the this is a problem for both stateful firewalls and servers. For web servers, it's also a problem, normal servers in general, because the OS needs to track all these things. But it's a little less concerning for the OS because, for one thing is that if you need to track these connections, but there's work you're doing for every connection anyways that could also be an issue, right? If you're mitigating the attacker overloading your server, you need to worry about much more than this. With a firewall, the firewall's not supposed to be doing any real work for the connection, right? It's supposed to be kind of just this tracking. And we can do this even if it's not going to a real server as an attacker. And for a firewall, this is going to be problematic if we're doing that connection tracking. Now, there's a common mitigation that endhosts use that kind of solves this tracking problem for them. But it's hard to use for firewalls. So that mitigation for endhosts is this idea called SYN cookies. So normally, what we do in a TCP connection is that we have a SYN sent in one direction, right? And then we have a SYN plus ACK sent, and then we have an ACK. This was what our TCP state machine said was our connection setup process. And what we have generally been doing is that when we get this SYN, we record, a new connection. And here we check our record of the connection. So SYN cookies are this idea that, we don't need to record that there's a new connection here. We just need to somehow verify that when we get this first ACK, that it really came from something that was a connection that we sent a SYN plus ACK for. So we want to somehow distinguish that from a random ACK that just came out of nowhere. And so the idea of SYN cookies is that we will send a message authentication code as that the sequence number for that ACK. And we'll verify that message authentication code when we receive it. And if it matches, then we're going to say, yes, this really is a reply to a SYN plus ACK I sent. If it doesn't match, it probably wasn't. And this allows us to filter out most of, so this allows us to reply to the SYN with something without recording anything besides the keys for that message authentication code, which can be the same for all the SYN plus ACKs we're sending back. And it allows us to check when we get an ACK with and be relatively sure. I say relatively sure because the sequence number is small, so there's a chance of collisions, even though this is a secure keyed hash. But be relatively sure that it's actually a reply to something we sent, and therefore not record state unless it actually came from one of our SYN plus ACKs, or the attacker got pretty lucky. Okay, so questions about this SYN cookie idea? So this is a common mitigation for servers that are worried about these SYN flood attacks, which can overload a table, especially because we typically want to 10, 20, 30 seconds for TCP connection to finish establishing for people with bad network connections. So we have this idea that actually verifies we have to go back and forth. Now for firewalls, there's a problem here because kind of the point of this scheme is that I can't compute the sequence number unless I'm the end host. If that was possible, then we'd have a new version of the attack where instead of sending a bunch of SYNs, we send a bunch of ACKs. So the firewall can't use this trick in an obvious way. So like this mitigation like worked really well end-to-end doesn't help our firewall. Now, despite this, Linux has a tool for doing this same mitigation with a stateful firewall, but we have to do some annoying extra work to make it happen, including changing the server. And they have a tool called SynProxy, where the firewall does syn cookies and then translates that and then does the syn cookie trick itself in place of the end server. So the firewall replies to the syn packets instead of the end server. To make this work, in addition to we're doing some filtering before things go to the server, you need to know what the syn plus ACK reply looks like. And by looks like, I mean, like, remember, we have things like TCP options, like, are we using timestamps? Are we using selective acknowledgments? All that information, the firewall needs to know what to send. And probably this breaks more TCP features because we're, doing more than just, accept rejecting things. So one other thing that came up here is we have this notion of related connections. And you might say, what does that mean, right? So it's pretty clear that that new, this is a starting a connection. Established is a part of a connection. And invalid is not part of a connection. But what is related? And related is for this issue where we have some protocols that use multiple connections. So as an example, FTP, the very old file transfer protocol, uses separate control and data connections. So here I have a Wireshark trace of an FTP session between 127.0.0.1 and 127.0.0.2. And we can see that we're sending a request, to the HTTP server over the control connection. And we send this port command. And that port command tells the server to connect back to us at that an address and port number specified by those numbers. The first few numbers are probably pretty obvious because it matches 127.0.0.1. The last two is the port number encoded in two numbers. Why do they do that? I don't know, but that's how that works. And normally, and very often, this is something that just won't work through firewalls because we have this fresh new TCP connection here, which you have to dig pretty deep to understand where does that come from. And that's an incoming TCP connection, so our outgoing rules. So even though this was an outgoing FTP session, we have a connection that appears to come from the other direction. That our kind of naive rules, you can send requests out but not get them sent in, will filter out, even though this is part of this FTP sort of session. So the Linux connection tracking tools support doing some pretty annoying and expensive monitoring of these connections and trying to figure out what's going on and looking for things like this, these port commands. And when that works and is enabled, because, well, it's not free from a processing time point of view, obviously, then this packet here should be marked as related. Now, you might say, you might be looking at this and say, wait, why does FTP have this port command where you connect back? Isn't that a silly protocol design? Like, if we want to have a separate connection to the server, shouldn't the client connect to the server? And that is a great idea, and also something FTP supports. So FTP supports both directions. So there's also a passive command which goes in the other direction, and most FTP clients use this mode by default these days. I mean, maybe that wasn't true in the early 90s. But you might say, so why do we have both? And probably the big thing, the big reason why FTP is designed this way, which, you know, actually is kind of clever, is that it allows direct server-to-server transfers, that you can connect to one FTP server and tell it to connect to another one because you're specifying where it connects to. And this would allow you to transfer a file between two servers without going through your machine, which, you know, is actually useful functionality and one of the reasons why I think some places still use FTP, usually FTP over TLS. So we can't actually detect the related connections anyways because it's encrypted. But some places still use that. And there are some other protocols that have these separate, you know, data control and data connections. You know, typically for cases where the data is sent like with UDP, so we'll have a TCP connection, but data is actually sent with UDP for like video or audio, or maybe it's sent from a different machine. So for example, many internet relay chat programs support direct client-to-client transfer, so we are both connected to a chat server, but we send a file between us without going through the server. And so that's the sort of things it supports. Now, I would say that this sort of related connection idea, like, it's a nice kind of hack, but it works really poorly with kind of modern sensibilities about how protocol should work, in that, like, it obviously doesn't work with encryption. Right? The reason we can mark this packet as related is that I can read the port command. But if we're encrypting everything, like we probably should, that's not really going to work. And we want some better way of signaling to the firewall what's going on, but that basically doesn't exist. Basically, what you do is you try really hard to make it an outgoing connection so the firewall will add it to its connection table. Okay, so we talked about our connection tracking, and once we have that, though, we mentioned the mark, so we can make our firewall rule, which kind of implements our only connect from the outside, from the inside to the outside, and don't allow otherwise. So here I'm saying every packet that's part of an established connection or related, accept it. Things that aren't, where we don't understand how it works with connections, drop it. And things that are new connections from inside, accept those, drop everything else. And this kind of implements our very common request for a firewall rule is internal stuff should be able to connect to the outside, but not the other way around. So then we have some other issues with state. Which is timeouts. So let's say I have a TCP connection with no activity for 30 minutes. Should I keep that in my firewalls table? How about if it's 8 hours? And if we want to like not annoy users, probably the answer is yes. But if we want our firewall to not run out of memory, maybe the answer isn't yes. And this is kind of a hard decision. Linux has configurable timeouts because this is something where system administrators might get annoyed. But their default is that they allow, in, if it's established TCP connection, 5-day timeouts. And this can agree with the end host timeouts kind of no matter how aggressive we are, right? So we can get these mysterious connection drops that wouldn't have happened if we didn't have a firewall. If we time out, the firewall times out and the end host doesn't. Right, and I forgot to add the other slide. Okay, so another thing with this is that it's very common for protocols, partly because this is going on, to do kind of keep alive. And there's two ways of doing keep alive. So in TCP, there's this SO keep alive socket option. And how this works is it sends sort of empty data packets and gets an ACK. Not empty, actually sort of resend the last byte. Last byte and get an ACK periodically. And a reason you do this is just to make sure that if anything like a firewall has a timeout, that it resets its timeout periodically. Also, this allows you to discover if the server actually went down, because eventually you won't get an ACK back. So this is an option you can enable. It's not enabled by default because, you know, it just sends extra stuff. You probably don't want to send extra stuff for no reason. The other way people do this kind of keep alive, keeping connections alive despite these timeouts, is sort of explicit ping and pong. So a lot of protocols which have very long-lived connections, so a classic example is like protocols for chat. You often have a connection that's active for a while with very little activity, will have ping pong messages that are supposed to be sent back and forth periodically, and a big part of the reason is to, you know, well, I guess a big practical reason is that it avoids issues with firewalls dropping the connection. Like probably the original and maybe more principled reason is that if a client gets disconnected, the server wants to not keep the connection around for hours despite that, and vice versa. So we'll have these periodic messages to, which can help with this, that will often be done, but yeah, the firewall, we can't really depend on that happening. So if we don't set one of these 5-day timeouts, you're probably gonna have some user who's like, why does this keep breaking? Okay. So that's on firewalls. So next we're going to talk a bit about network address translation, which we alluded to a bunch of times earlier. And the reason I'm talking about it now is that we've accidentally created most of the machinery we need for network address translation. So network address translation, what is this? The idea is that we take a packet that goes to one address and translate it to go to a different address. And usually the purpose of this is that we are using IP version 4 and we can't afford to get IP addresses for every single machine on our internal network. So I have this internal network with five machines plus a router here. And I have an external network where I have one IPv4 address. And I want to share that one IPv4 address among all those five machines on the router. So what we'll do is we'll take packets from the outside that use the external IP address and rewrite them to use the internal one. Now, since we're sharing an IP address, we need to somehow figure out which packet goes where, and we're going to use these port numbers to do that. And we want to know when one port number should go to another, and well, that information is our connection tracking. I said when we track our connections, right, we're tracking the port on either end. So we're just going to have this table, and we're going to add to it kind of the internal port and the public one. So if we're thinking about what the firewall does, we're going to get a SYN packet typically from the internal IPN port, and we're going to assign a public IPN port. And then we're going to add that to our table. And now this table entry is not only going to tell us, is this part of a real connection, it's going to tell us how to change the address when it goes from the internal network to the public network. So even though network address translation isn't a firewall, kind of often the way it works is it reuses stuff that's made for firewalls. And this is the case in the Linux infrastructure for doing this, which is also used by a lot of home routers because there are a lot of them are Linux-based internally. That infrastructure kind of does this connection tracking, which is both for firewalls and to implement this NAT idea. It's the same code because we want to track the same information. Question?
Yeah, I might have just missed it, but what's the difference between remote and public again?
By remote, I mean the one over here. By public, I mean the one here. And the private is the one here.
The remote is like the source.
The remote is the one that's on the external network. So I'm not saying source because we can imagine this working in the other direction too. And in fact, like here I'm filtering from the outside, but we're going to have to do the inverse filtering on the other direction. Right, that I'm going to have something that comes from 192.168.1.4, and it needs to end up coming from 203.0.113.43. So we're going to use that table in both directions. And so this gives us the kind of illusion that we have some private IP addresses communicating directly with this public IP. So from the perspective of my machine here, I just connect to this remote server and it just works. And it's as if my IP address is just a normal internet IP address. So if I'm inside the network, I just use my private address. As if it's local, I use the remote address that's the normal one. And I never see the router being involved here. So I don't even, deal with, in my, as a client, any of the router's IP addresses. They just don't appear to me. Obviously, they're involved internally, but I'm opening a TCP connection from 192.168.1.4 to 1234, those are the addresses I see. I don't see any of the others. And outside, they never see the 192.168 address. They only see the public one. And it's as if they're communicating to a machine with a real publicly routable address. And I've shown network address translation here where the router has one public IP. If we are worried about running out of port numbers, so for example, if we're doing this for like a cellular provider, then we can use multiple public IPs to spread this out. So that's kind of the basics of network address translation. Now, there's a few issues with this. So I showed this for TCP, but maybe for UDP, it's a little less straightforward. We have this notion for our firewall of connections with UDP, but I was kind of vague about what is, one of these table entries actually look like for UDP. Like what I'm showing here is that we have a specific host we're communicating with. This is port 53, which is probably DNS. So we're getting back DNS requests and forward and then back. But if you remember the way UDP sockets work, when you make a UDP socket, you can receive from anywhere. So maybe it really should be something like this. And this is actually useful for TCP too. We might want to deliberately reuse a source port, for the same thing. In particular, if we want people to connect back to us, that's a reasonable way of doing it. And this is actually the most common thing NAT implementations do, is that they use this kind of mapping for both UDP and TCP. And this is called an endpoint independent mapping, because it doesn't matter what the remote host is, it's going to get the same, it's going to have the same IP import to mapping. And this is most common NAT implementation, so it's not done everywhere, and in particular it limits to some extent how many hosts we can easily support versus the flexibility that reusing the same port number for different connections would let us do, which we could do. But the common observation is that we have a lot of port numbers versus the typical number of connections we have to manage, and it's kind of useful if the port number is used consistently anyways. And we'll see that it's useful in other ways. And you might say, okay, so if we're doing this, though, does that mean we have to, that now we're going to allow incoming connections, especially when doing this for TCP? And the answer is no, because just because I'm using that any entry for my translation doesn't mean I need to use it for my filtering. Right, I can still have a separate table for filtering that has the full information versus the table I use for the actual network address translation. And this is a relatively common thing, is that our firewall rules will filter out two specific ports and host names, even though we have a translation rule that says, everything that goes to this port goes to this internal port. So we don't need to keep it the same, and typically will not. And that's because we have different goals here, right? Our network address translation goal is just make it appear that your IP and port is on the public internet. The firewall goal here, if we're doing this kind of filtering, is probably to make it so you don't get packets that you didn't solicit. And for that reason, we're going to have different tables to implement those two ideas. So one issue here is that it seems like we can't really run servers on our private network, right? If we're thinking of running a server, someone connects to a server with a port number. How do we make that work? And we'll talk about a bunch of options. So the simplest is that some system administrator configures some static entries in this mapping. Just fixed table entries, and most NAT systems will let you do this. You just have a fixed table entry in the mapping, that says this port number and our public IP goes to this port number and a private IP. So in this example, I've decided that the internal IP 192.168.1.100 should receive connections to ports 443 and 22, that are made for the public IP on the corresponding private IP without the port number, destination port number changing. And because this is statically configured, we don't have to worry about this timing out. It's just there. This is good for servers like web servers that we run on port 443 or an SSH server that we run on port 22, we're probably the system administrators involved in configuring it. But we also have cases where we want to make kind of connections dynamically. So let's say, for example, I want to have a direct video call between two users. So we are both behind a network address translation box because it's hard to get IPv4 addresses. And we would like to have a direct video call. It would be faster if we don't go through Google servers, or some other, Zoom servers, right? It's faster to send the video directly. So can we make that happen? And to do that, one of us needs to connect to the other, and we need a port number you can connect to. How do we arrange that? And there's multiple solutions. So one idea is we can ask the router to add an explicit table entry to let us accept an incoming connection. So this is probably the conceptually simplest, though it requires the router to implement things. And there's three different protocols for doing this. Don't ask me why there's three different ones with, I'm sure, varying levels of actually being available. But there are three different ones, at least, that are common. And generally, the way these work is they're discovered via UDP broadcast or multicast. So you ask, hey, is there a router here that can give me forwarding? You'll get a reply. And they'll let you learn what the public IP is, so you can tell someone how to connect back to you. And they'll let you request an externally accessible port, basically request to add a forwarding entry that's permanent, and typically they'll have some sort of lease time, so you'll add one and it'll be like valid for 10 minutes or something like that. So this works great if we have support from our box that is doing the network address translation. That's not always something we can count on, and historically has very much not been something you could count on. So another idea is that we can try to coordinate to set up the connection. And here we're going to take advantage of the fact that usually we do this endpoint independent mapping. And so that means we can learn what the mapping is and just use that. And if there isn't a firewall rule preventing new connections, then we just need to figure out what that mapping is and have the other end connect to it once we figure that out. So how can we do this? Well, we choose some local IP address plus port, and that's going to have an entry in the table, which is kind of remote, public, private, right? So we're going to have our XY here, and this is going to be ZW, any, right? So when we make a connection with that, we have a new table entry that maps it from it to ZW from XY. And we want to figure that out. How can we figure that out? So the sort of simplest way is that we have someone running a server that will tell us where did we connect from. And there's a protocol for this called STUN that is commonly used in the sort of video conferencing land. So we connect to that server and we learn what Z and W are from the server for our particular X and Y. Then we use the same, or then we tell the other end that's going to connect to us for a video call, somehow, probably like through an external server where we're just sending like a little bit of text, that, hey, connect to ZW, and we have a server running on port XY, we know it's going to be forwarded through, and we can handle getting our video call. And the other end can also do this for us, so we can like simultaneously connect to each other. And if we simultaneously connect to each other, this actually even deals with the firewall rule case, because what will happen is that we'll both send a SYN packet, And that will both add a firewall table entry saying this is a valid new connection. And so even if we have a firewall rule which disallows incoming connections, it will say, oh, these are both outgoing connections if we coordinate opening it. Yeah?
So like practically, is this just equal to like a system admin adding to the table as necessary?
Question, is this practically just equal to the system and adding to the table as necessary? So this isn't the same as our static table entries. In a big way is that these like last forever, right? And this is, since we're reusing the existing mapping, we still also have all these timeouts and things like that. Like the mapping's not going to stay around forever. You know, there's going to be some sort of process to clean up the mappings. Because otherwise we'd run out of port numbers, right, if we just kept them around forever.
Then would it be practically system admin adding and deleting entries?
So question, is it like a system admin adding and deleting entries? Yeah, so I would say when you make a connection, it's kind of like the system admin adding an entry, right? That happens automatically, yeah. So we're just taking advantage of that process. Yeah. And so I mentioned how we deal with, there's a couple complications. So the biggest one is that if we have this handles like making the translation work, it doesn't handle making the firewall work. The way we can fix that is have both ends, you know, send something first. For UDP, they just send a packet that they don't expect to get there first. For TCP, if we both open a connection at the same time, that will both, the SYN will both add that new connection to the table for the firewall, and maybe one of them gets filtered out, depending if one of them's first, but that's fine, it will get resent because that's how TCP works. There's another issue which has come up in practice, which is that some home routers have made some poor design decisions. And there's a lot of stuff dealing with network address translation, which is all about working around poor design decisions by home router manufacturers. And one of these poor design decisions is they said, you know, a way we can fix, you know, this network address translation, like breaking people's video games, is by looking in the packets for someone sending the IP address of their private IP address and fixing it for them. And they probably found that this made like some video games or something like that work. So they just do that. And where this isn't great is that when we contact our external server to learn our IP address and port, this filtering means that we learn our private IP address and port, because it gets changed on the way in. So I would say the NAT should not have done this. You don't, like, but this is a case where they decided we don't care if we understand what this protocol is. We're just going to filter. We're just going to do this translation. Like, I think this is, like, really stupid because probably you're going to corrupt a file at some point. Yeah, or break video or something. But they did this anyways. The STUN protocol has a workaround for this, which is that they have an option to obfuscate the IP address by just XORing it with something, just to evade this clever, helpful filtering. So, yeah, that was our coordinate to set up the connection. So there we were taking advantage of the fact that, well, if the mapping's consistent, we can just figure out what the mapping is and use that to accept incoming packets deliberately. The sort of other option is that we can go through a relay. And that's kind of our last resort. But, you know, so often that's what you have to do. And there's a protocol for that. There's a protocol called TURN, transversal using relays around NAT. And TURN along with STUN, the STUN protocol for finding out what's your external address and port, and TURN for, you know, setting up these relays, is what's used by WebRTC, which is kind of the standard for web browser, in web browser video audio conferencing support. So they're supported by that, you know, because, you know, video audio conferencing, this is something where we want to do this. We want to have direct connections. Yes. Also, I should mention, there's some other fun issues that come up with this network address translation, which are going to make this more complicated. So one issue is, what happens if we have two hosts behind the same NAT? So what's going to happen with these various schemes? We have two hosts behind the same NAT, and we try to use this to connect to each other. So who thinks it's going to work? That it's going to function with asking the router to add a table entry? Who thinks that'll work if we're using this to communicate between two hosts which are on the same private network? But they don't know that, so they add these table entries. Who thinks that we'll have our connection will be successful? Thinks our connection will not be successful? No clue. Okay.
I think it'll work, like, if it's two in the same private network, it might work.
So it's two in the same private network. Basically, what's going to happen is 192.168 is going to connect to 203.0.113.43. And say 192.168.4 going to connect to the same thing. That's going to be fine. What's going to happen is it's going to go to the router. The router is going to translate the private to public IP and then translate it back, and we'll have an entry that like does the translation in both directions. So that does work, but it's just inefficient because we're going to translate our private IP to the public IP, and basically what we're going to end up having is we're going to have kind of a connection from the router to itself that everything goes through. That the 192.168.1.2 gets translated to an IP address, to the 208, to the public address, then it goes into the public address, then the packet goes back into the public address, then that gets translated from the public address to the destination for the destination, but after the source was translated to the public address. Yeah.
So did they use like different port numbers? Because otherwise, how does the table
So they use different port numbers? Yes. So we'll have basically we'll have kind of, where's my table example? We'll have like two entries in this table, right? Which have different remote IPs and the same and two different ports. Right, so we have the .1 entry and the .4 entry, or .2 entry, I think it was my example. One port, or I should say they're at the different place, so we'll have the .1 entry, .2 and .4 here, and we'll have the public IP will be, the remote and public IP will just be the same for each of these, but this will be to that, they'll be connected to each other. Right, because remember, each of these entries is only for one direction, so we'll have one for both directions. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I was kind of wondering, if you want to send like from different ports, but on the same network, or on the same IP, would that be like a very minimal connection, or would that...
The question is, if I want to send from different ports, what do you mean by send from different ports?
Just like in this occasion, right? You're basically sending stuff from one port to another port on the same IP address on the router.
So your question is, like, how much work is that? So the router is just doing... The packets shouldn't go beyond the router. The router will look at its routing table and say, oh, I know how to route this packet that goes to my own IP address. It goes here. But the packets still need to get to the router when maybe, depending on how our network works, they could go directly between the two hosts. So that works fine with two hosts behind the same NAT. Coordinating with the other end will therefore also work fine, same issue. And going through relay will work. How about if we have nested NATs? So a situation we might have is my ISP ran out of public IP addresses, so I get a fake IP address, but they only give me one of those for some reason, so I run NAT again. So we have two layers of network address translation. And this is probably actually a common case, like if you have a cellular internet connection that you're sharing with multiple devices. So who thinks adding the router out of the table entry would work in that case? Thinks it would not work. Okay, so we have a split there. And it depends is probably the answer. So what's supposed to happen is that when you use this request, that if we have our NAT 1 to NAT 2, is that NAT 1 is supposed to like use this, and we're requesting from here, is that when you make a request here, the implementation of this protocol, what it should do is make a request here. Does that happen consistently? Probably not. So it should work. It probably doesn't always work. Our coordinating this with the other end to set up the connection and going through a relay, those should still work, but we might not be taking the most efficient path. We might be going all the way to the last NAT and back. Another thing to note here is I said we have this endpoint independent mapping. As I mentioned, this is not something you have to do. And if we don't have that endpoint independent mapping, then this coordinating with the other end to set up the connection idea just doesn't work. So we're just going to be stuck. And I already did that exercise. The other thing about nested NAT is that there's this, conceptually, it doesn't have to be the case that the addresses are unique. So conceptually, we could imagine 10/8 is a private address range, 10/8. We could imagine having two layers of NAT where we use the same address ranges on either end. And conceptually, there's nothing to prevent this from working. Practically speaking, a lot of stuff breaks. Because you need to like think carefully about when you're doing the forwarding, like to make sure you track where is it, what connection is supposed to be going on based on how I've changed the address. And a lot of NAT boxes don't do that. And for this reason, there's this special IP space for so-called carrier-grade NAT in 100.64, where there's a requirement that if you use this, your device has to support this kind of scenario, where we can have nested NAT with the same set of same network IP addresses on both sides. Some questions about nested NAT. Okay, so I guess in my last 2 minutes, I'll talk briefly about kind of, you know, we're not going to talk about how they work in detail, but talk about kind of fancier firewall things. So one thing, set type of rules that firewalls will often have that we didn't show is that often we want to not just use them to filter packets for, you know, dropping or not dropping, but to save things for later analysis or to like trigger rules. So maybe we want to add a new, maybe if like there's certain types of too much traffic, we want to trigger a new drop rule for the source IP address of that packet, for example. Or maybe we just want to have alerts sent to our system and to look at something. So that those are other types of firewall actions that we could imagine supporting that we didn't see. The other thing is that often you'll want to have firewalls that do something fancier than just simple packet matching, like do pattern matching, like regular expression type stuff. And often when people add these kinds of capabilities to the firewalls or focus on these kind of extra actions for a firewall to take, they call it something other than a firewall. And the two terms you'll often see are intrusion detection system or intrusion prevention system. So an intrusion detection system usually is basically a fancy firewall that mostly is just logging stuff. An intrusion prevention system is basically a fancy firewall that's doing more than logging stuff and often doing like adding new firewall rules based on what happens. And these often support pretty fancy rules. So snort is a well-known IDS, and this is a snort rule that, yes, this is not an HTTP proxy. This is just a fire. This is just looking at packets, but it reconstructs enough to match against post requests. Oh, I see. To match against post requests, looking for a particular URL and so on. And you know, that this is a thing people in the security field like for what's going on in my network type of tools. And that's where I'm out of time for today. So next time we'll be talking about, and probably as our last topic, about encapsulation. So things like VPNs and various applications of that sort of technology.